I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit about Turkey. There's been some stuff happening over there. I'm sure everybody's aware of it. But the it seems like, Austin, that Turkey has a great history of coups. But, you know, probably they moved toward away from sectarianism and secularism when Ataturk staged his coup back in the after World War One, and you've written about that. Why don't you get us started on that?
Ataturk didn't stage a coup. He staged a revolution, and it was in favor of secularism, of course.
Right.
Reestablishment of a parliamentary system, secular laws created by a parliament, an elected parliament, established rule of law, and he in 1924 did something that still makes him the most hated man by Al-Qaeda and Islamic State types. He's the one who offed the caliphate. So he says, it's fine to have your religious faith, but here's the reality that the best way to protect religious freedom and freedom of speech is a secular, popularly elected parliament, democratic system. And even though he was a military officer and autocratic in his own way, what he did was establish the way I've worded it, actually a way that I think his greatest biographer Andrew Mango words it, a democratic orientation, that his hope was that Turkey would eventually evolve into a Western European type parliamentary democracy. He told the military, it's your job to ensure that happens, which became the guidance for military action when Islamists of various stripes started to demand changes to the constitutional structure, or took power, or threatened the secular nature of what is sometimes called the Kemalist state, but they call it a Western European democratic system is, I think, more accurate. Several coups. The one that is the most controversial, Dan, up until now, was 1980, led by a general whose last name was Efren. There was a lot of chaos in Turkey at the time, a lot of leftist chaos. Cold War is still very, very much is rolling. The Russians are always finagling with Turkey, and here's Turkey on NATO's southern flank, and the military moved to restore order. But what happened after that was the military essentially enshrined special privileges for the military in the Constitution, and that riled Turks across the political spectrum, even those who had supported the action taken in 1980. Now, just a brief aside on this, I've known over the years a couple of Americans who were there, one on a Fulbright scholarship at the time, and both of them said their experience, and they're both individuals who extremely knowledgeable about Turkey, said the coup was welcomed by almost everyone because the government was just flailing. But over time, what was not welcomed were some of those legal changes and also military behavior. There was corruption in the military. And one of the terms that I think is descriptive of it is that it was a Praetorian constitution or Praetorianism. Instead of acting as a guardian of democratic principles, they usurped it. And they reference, of course, is to the Praetorian Guard nominating and changing Caesars at will at the end of the Roman Empire. So move into the 1990s, and I'll tell a brief personal story here. I was in Turkey in 1992, saw there in Istanbul actually two different flavors of Islamist demonstrations. I talked with a number of Turks about it, and then a couple of these folks already knew that I was an admirer of Kemal Atatürk. I'm sure that's some of the reason that we have some of these long discussions, because of my reasonable familiarity with Turkish history, Ottoman history, Balkan history, and also somewhat knowledgeable about Atatürk at the time. And their view was that there was it had never gone away, but the, you know, an Islamist surge, though there really were and are what we'll call democratic Islamists, moderate Islamists. So I came back and I actually wrote an essay, a short essay about it. And I told several people that, well, we're going to see another revival here. It's going to be interesting because Turkey is it's experimenting with taming the Muslim cultural demands that make political demands, or make, in many cases, absolutist political demands. And look at the year on this. This is 1992. Some degree, I'm just repeating what I'd been told by very knowledgeable Turks that I'd met with, and a couple of them my friends. And sure enough, we see the various revivals, and one of the key figures in this growing moderate Islamist movement is Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And that's he does make some wild statements. I'm paraphrasing, but you can see it in my Creator Syndicate column this week. You know, democracy is a train you get off of, and then you ride until you need to get off, and then we get off. That's the paraphrase. Of course, he now says, and he starts saying, "I was giving a very wild and emotional speech. Don't criticize me for it. I didn't mean it that way." He also did a little time in jail for any government activities. It embittered him, perhaps embittered him to the point of paranoia. I'm not going to play psychobabble, but that there are a lot of folks that think that's what was going on. At the same time, he was a successful politician, and he got elected mayor of Istanbul. And he did a reasonable job of running Istanbul. So much so that by 2002, the Justice and Development Party, AKP, his party wins the election, and I think it's 2003, he's prime minister. And so here's the experiment with taming Islamist demands. And, of course, I heard it. I'm not going to say I was well tied into it, but I have enough contacts with Turks and certainly reading and covering it. Heck, we were covering Turkey on a 2 or 3 week basis on Strategy Page at that time under the old Kurd War section, and also in the Balkans. You'd get it in the coverage of issues in Turkey and the way we used to cover it was because certainly listen, Thrace and Istanbul were in the Balkans, and but so I was staying up on it from the point of what we do with Strategy Page. Well, you see, active in the way Erdogan was running the state, his fear that he's going to face a coup, and he was convinced that the military was planning a coup. He had several scores of the number runs into the hundreds, but the critical cadre on this was a couple of hundred officers were arrested or detained or kicked out of the service for at least a couple of alleged coup coup conspiracies. Many of them were absolved by the judicial process. This angered Erdogan. And just everybody remember that, because I'm talking about the judicial process. Over the period, really, and it begins 2006, 2007, even though you can see the roots before that, he starts to try to consolidate more power in really whatever office he's in. And his key goal was to take the presidency, which had been a more or less symbolic office over prime minister, give it more authority, and then become president, which is what he's done. So there's the build-up. Along the way, he gets the nickname Sultan Recep, and that's it's funny, but it's not funny, meaning that he's acting like an Ottoman sultan. He's and there are legitimate fears of his consolidation of power in the hands of a single executive, and it's going to be him, Erdogan. He manages, though, to win several elections, Dan, including the snap election last November that he called, and the AKP keeps power. It doesn't have enough to rewrite the Constitution to make some of these firm up the power consolidation. And then we move to, I'll quickly sketch this. There's a movement called Hizmet that is led by a Islamist, Muslim cleric, I should say this, named Fethullah Gulen. And he portrays himself as a reformer. He was very much a supporter of Erdogan. He's been in exile here in the United States for, I want to say, 17 or 18 years. I mean, that's something that a quick internet search would confirm. And he lives in Pennsylvania. And there's the Gulen movement turned on Erdogan because of evidence of corruption in his regime. That's what they say, and that's what you could see a change in the way that the Gulen supporters living in Turkey regard Erdogan when after revelations of corruption in the Justice and Development Party, the AKP. And from what we can tell, even though there's several very interesting stories that I've read in Hürriyet, which is the big Turkish newspaper published in Istanbul, they have a English language website, HürriyetDailyNews.com, that is I try to check out. Well, now I'm checking it out on a daily basis, but usually I look at it about once a week. There are indications that the government was going to move against some Gulenists, and when I say that, they're all over the place. They're teachers, firemen, policemen, they're in the military, they're in commercial jobs and the like, because it's a spiritual flavor of Islam. And okay, it's got the issues, so there's that we up front about it. And some of its critics, both who happen to be Muslim and secular alike, say that Hizmet has elements of a cult to it, and Gulen is treated as a cult leader. I think there's evidence for that, but there's no evidence of criminal activity that I was aware of. However, the Hürriyet reports say that there was evidence that they were plotting something. Well, sure enough, we have the coup attempt. It looked to me like it was just not coming off. It was so slow compared to the way the classic Turkish general staff coups had come off. And I think that perception at a distance is accurate. However, things we've learned since, there was an attempt on Erdogan's life. There are people out there that doubt it, but they've captured some of the soldiers that were part of it. They claim that they were being told by their superiors that they were going to attack a terrorist, and that was what they were to do. The assault came 15 or 20 minutes after Erdogan had left, and a couple of his bodyguards were still there, and they died in the attack, in the shootout. So there were some things that you associate with a coup d'etat, and they failed. One of the biggest reasons they failed, though, Dan, and this is I've seen this coming. I've read this and been told this, is that, look, the Turks are very proud of their democracy, and they weren't going to have military coups anymore. They were going to do it, you know, to use the phrase, by ballots, not bullets. But what's happened, especially in the last 72 hours, and we're recording this, a little over a week after the coup, right? Erdogan is in the process of moving from defensible response to a criminal action to solidifying control, eliminating judges who were in his way. Two of the people that he fired or purged were on that constitutional court. And if I recall correctly, they were opposed to his demands for increasing the authority of the presidency and constitutional changes that Erdogan has been advocating. He's suspended, if not fired, between 20 and 22,000 administrators and teachers that he says they're all Gulenists. Well, were they involved in the coup? You see where I'm going with that, Dan? Becomes extra-constitutional and extrajudicial action, and that's ratified by the fact that he's established a state of emergency, which Turkey's had before. France is under a state of emergency right now because of the militant Islamist terror attacks, and it's allowed under the European Convention on Human Rights, to which Turkey ascribes, and so does France. And Erdogan I haven't read this, but I'm sure if somebody questions him, he says, France doing it, go talk to France about it. But I don't see the French state doing what he's doing, and it's all about him. So in other words, this failed coup d'etat, launched for whatever reason. And yes, there are conspiracy theorists out there saying, well, he faked it. Doesn't look like it. Nobody that I respect or any media organization out of Turkey that I find credible thinks it was faked. It was inept. It was stupid. And look what he's doing. And in other words, he's moving back to what calling him Sultan Recep is not a joke. He's undermining the democracy that saved him. Now, that's the way I framed my essay this week. So at this point, Jim, I've kind of talked it out of the and the other thing is he is really undermining the democratic institutions that Kemal Atatürk established with his nationalist revolution. It's one other comment on this. About that is that Erdogan is just jealous as he can be of Atatürk, and he wants to be the equivalent. Well, the only thing he can do apparently this time, instead of improving or ratifying the gift of democracy, he's going to usurp it. And that's the way it looks at me. It looks to me at this moment in time. I'll turn it over to Jim because I know he's got a lot to say about this.
Jim?
The problem with corruption in Turkey, or Anatolia as it's been known, you know, for thousands of years, that is basically the area that is now modern Turkey, goes way back. It was one of the reasons why Alexander the Great was able to conquer the Persian Empire 2,400 years ago, It's the reason why the Ottoman Turks were able to eventually, you know, conquer the area and take Constantinople. One could say that corruption did in the Roman Empire in the East as much as the Arabs, the Muslim Arabs, and the Turks did. The Ataturk Revolution didn't have dealing with corruption as a major, you know, goal. I mean, it was there, but there were more pressing matters, you know, like basically separating church and state, which is much more difficult in a Muslim, you know, culture than it is in a Christian or any other non-Judeo-Christian one. Ever since the time of Ataturk, as Austin has pointed out, you know, Turkey became more corrupt. And when they were in the night after the Cold War ended, Turkey, you know, considered itself one of the victors because they were an early, you know, member of NATO, the only non-European member, non-Christian member, so to speak. And they wanted to join the European Union. And the European Union told them, well, no, this is, there are certain, you know, governance and economic, you know, standards you have to meet. Now, ironically, Greece was in the same boat because Greece had been more than any other country occupied by the Muslims for the longest period of time. And the Greeks, you know, to the Romans were corrupt. I mean, they were a superior civilization and everything. And an educated Roman, you know, learned to speak Greek. And that's how you could tell if some guy was a real, you know, upper crust twit, if he could speak Greek. But at the same time, they disdained the Greeks for basically, you know, crippling themselves by being disunited and corrupt. The Romans, relatively speaking, were very incorrupt. One reason the Romans were successful in the East was they basically installed, while it was a foreign government, but most of the countries over there were accustomed to being, you know, subject to some, you know, foreign, you know, power. The Romans were relatively honest. You know, it was good for business because you could have business dispute. You get a Roman judge who would basically make a fair ruling, and that'd be as easy to buy off as in the past. In other words, none of the crony capitalism, as it were, that we see so much, you know, even today. The Romans, as many Romans, you know, Roman commentators, you know, pointed out, are eventually going to succumb to the corruption, and they did, and that's one of the reasons why the Roman Empire, both East and West, you know, eventually collapsed. But the West basically came out of the corruption morass. This was started with the Age of Enlightenment, you know, the Renaissance, you might say. It was an offshoot of that. The Roman Republics, you know, before Italy got united in the 19th century, some of them were noted as reliable, in other words, honest. It was good for business, as the Italians, the Romans used to say. They had a democratic and a relatively low corruption. That sounds ironic today because, you know, the southern members of the European Union are considered more corrupt, but they were always more corrupt. It's a Mediterranean thing. Who the heck knows? But the people who really got going on suppressing corruption in a big way were the Germans and the Scandinavians. Again, it was a cultural thing. You know, it was part of the Protestant Reformation. Luther was famously railing against the church for corruption, which was emanating, you know, mostly from Rome. He was right in that respect. I mean, that's one thing even a lot of, you know, Catholic historians will agree on, that there was a corruption problem. That was one of the defining elements in the rise of the West, as it were. When they went into the East, went into India, went into China, they were basically, you know, less corrupt and thus more efficient. And that's something, you know, the local cultures that they, you know, invaded, occupied, and eventually withdrew from, they don't like to admit. It's still a tremendous problem in India and China, for example. It's a huge problem. And even the Chinese Communist Party, which still rules the place, it's one of the few remaining and the largest communist police states around. Although the Chinese adopted a market economy and with it a degree of honesty in adjudicating commercial disputes, the corruption was still there, as Western firms learned. And they were told by, you know, the Chinese, oh, no, not the old China, new China. Unfortunately, the new China, by Western standards, was incredibly corrupt. And a lot of Western firms have since, you know, either pulled out or basically lowered their profile because you can't make money when it's that corrupt. Russia had another problem. They were occupied by the Mongols. They were heavily influenced by the East over centuries. They achieved a degree of corruption which was considered almost, you know, Greek. Well, they did base their language, their alphabet at least, on the Greek one. But they also, like the ancient Romans, they ate initially the Greek culture, where the Christian missionaries came from. But they had their own corruption, and they never really got out of it. One reason the communists were able to, the Romanov Empire, the Russian Empire, fell was because of the corruption. That's one thing everybody could agree on, you know, in 1917 when the Russian Empire was coming apart. The communists, like all, you know, radicals, said, hey, we're going to clean it up. They really didn't. They did for a while, but it took less than a decade before the corruption started creeping back in. And it's still there. It's still a major problem in Russia. And as Austin pointed out, you know, Erdogan came on strong. You know, he was a classic, you know, Kemalist in terms of governance. He was a clean government in the capital, in the major cities. He basically wrote the book on that, and that when he took over, you know, around 2000, that led to a steady increase in the economy, and everybody, even the European observers in the EU, could agree, yes, it's less corrupt. But now it took him less than a decade to start getting corrupt again. And that's what his current rival, an exile, Gulen, is complaining about. But the problem is, you know, you don't turn off corruption like turning off a tap. It's a generational thing. It took Europe generations, centuries, really, to get to the state where they are now. You look at the Transparency International rankings. I think Denmark has been number one or in the top three for, you know, decades. United States used to be up there in the top five. We're now barely in the top 20. We'll get into that because it's election season. The problem is corruption never goes away. You can control it. You know, it's like, in American business, we have a thing since World War II called risk management. You can't eliminate risk. But if you keep an eye on it, you can manage it. But the minute you turn your back, things are going to start coming apart. Anybody who's run a business can, you know, understand that. And Erdogan basically still has a populist appeal. But then so did, the Bolivarists, you know, the socialists down in Venezuela. Chavez, you know, got elected, socialist reform thing. And, by the time he died in 2013, it was estimated that his members of his family, as it were worth over $4 billion. And they'd never been rich before. So, you see a pattern there. And of course, Venezuela is a classic case of, you know, the socialism practiced, and then the country falling apart. In Turkey, it's different because they're not looking for socialism per se. Erdogan wants to basically turn it back into an Islamic state, where Islam is the state religion, which Ataturk got rid of. And, you know, even though he expelled a lot of Greek Christians, but that was more for politics, you know, than for religious reasons, it remained a haven for Jews. And a lot of minorities who were technically Muslim but were considered heretics by most Muslims, by mainstream Muslims. He basically wants to reverse all those changes. And a lot of, since the majority of Turks still consider themselves Muslims, and the majority of Turks basically have not yet experienced the Industrial Revolution. That's an important point to make. Outside of the major cities, which were always more cosmopolitan, more economically advanced, wealthier, it was still basically an agrarian, a type of culture that you haven't seen in America for over 100 years. And any American servicemen, especially guys who and I spoke to many over the years, who served the Incirlik when it was a major, NATO air base down there during the Cold War, they joke about, Incirlik, being stationed in Constantinople was a great, a place to be assigned. But if you went to Incirlik, it was like going to Korea. It was a hardship tour. Actually, it was worse than Korea, because in Korea, the local women for a price would be very friendly. You couldn't do that in Incirlik, and basically you were restricted. They were told NATO troops, especially American troops, learned early on, you're not in Europe anymore. And when you're in Incirlik, you're basically back, way, way back. And don't talk to the women, don't look at the women, don't drink off base, et cetera, et cetera. And those who basically disobeyed, either got a local justice, which was often quite brutal, or they got, charged by the military. We tend to lose sight of that because many Turkish politicians did not. And Erdogan took full advantage of it. He did the same thing that happened in Iran. Iran was a similar situation where when the Shah was in power, the oil money was coming in, and people said, Iran is going to enter the 20th century. Well, not so fast. Because they did it ineptly, there was a lot of corruption, and comes the invasion from Iraq unexpected. Well, that came after the uprising. First, there was a religious uprising, which the Shah, could not handle. And when they were in the midst of that, in comes the Iraqi invasion, and that gives the Islamists, Shia Islamists in Iran, the opportunity to turn what was intended to be a democracy. In other words, when the Shah was overthrown, it was agreed until the mid-80s that the new constitution was going to be basically, recognize Islam as the majority religion, but it was going to be a democracy. Well, because of the war with Iraq, it basically, turned into an Islamic dictatorship, and it's still that way. So this is a problem that, the American State Department was slow to pick up on, and I know this for a fact, because I had a gal working for me once back in the 70s who had served in the Peace Corps in Iran. Peace Corps was a big deal back in the 60s and 70s. And so I talked to her about it, and she said, I was out in the countryside. I said, what was it like? And she said, it was nothing like Tehran. He said, they were old school out there. And I said, well, isn't that interesting? And so in the 70s, I was becoming an expert on modeling and simulation down in the Pentagon, and of course the State Department heard about it. So this is even before the collapse in 79 in Iran. So I asked him, I said, what are you doing about the problem out in the countryside where the majority of Iranians are still, old school Muslim? And he says, what are you talking about? And I said, I said to myself. Later on, I learned it was better just to speak up and make yourself unpopular. At least you'd get the message out. Some people in the State Department picked on it, but it was too late. And after that, the story became, we had no idea. Actually, some people did, but white people weren't listening. Same thing has happened in Turkey, and there's no easy way to reverse it. A lot of people, the majority of Turks, do not want another coup. Austin, I agree with Austin. There's something fishy about this coup. Exactly who is behind it? I mean, the blowback has been way disproportionate. As Austin pointed out, Erdogan is cleaning house. He's getting anybody of a secularist frame of mind, whether they back a coup or not, and majority of the people being arrested and fired from their jobs and what have you are believers in Turkish democracy, not in Turkish military dictatorship. And I know this for a fact, I know a lot of Turks do, and they, to a man and woman, do not want more military dictatorships. But a lot of them are souring on this idea that Islam is the solution. Islam, as Ataturk pointed out, is the problem. It's part of the problem. And now it's the main problem. So this is either going to end well or it's going to end very badly.
Jim, let me insert something there. It looks to me, based on what I've been able to gather from, and I have gotten some emails from friends of mine who are Turks in Turkey, but and from reading what I can read in the open media, that a lot of the people purged and arrested are Gulen Islamists. They're Muslims. But the deal with that with Fethullah Gulen is when you say that they're for secular the secular democracy. So that is the, but he's Erdogan is purging. He's purging people who oppose him, whatever
yes. and,
their,
yeah, and
whatever
always,
their faith, whatever.
And he's always had two major groups of enemies, according to him. One is the military, because he's been cleaning out the military diligently ever since he's been in power, without totally crippling it. But the other one, of course, is Muslims who don't agree with him, and Gulen is. Basically inspires the majority of them. And a lot of them, try to keep their, how should I put it, enthusiasm for Gulen, low key. They felt, hey, we're in a democracy, as long as I don't, preach revolution or take up arms against the state, I'm entitled to my opinions, I can vote. And Bulas has settled it that way. Well, Erdogan has basically torn up that particular, understanding, and that's going to have repercussions down the road. I think the Kemalists are going to make a comeback.
I agree with that. I think that is something to definitely look for. A Kemalist Republican People's Party, CHP, comeback. I'm not sure how we're going to see that happen, but that's there's been a momentum shift. There's another group too that it's there. I forget which percentage of Turks are Alevis. It's a Shia. It's often the Alevis are often classified as Shia, not Sunni, Muslims. And they don't like a lot of ways that they distrust Erdogan's solidification of power. From what I gather reading about what they say, so you're getting these disparate Islamic oriented Turks. You've already got the secular Turks across the board. What they agree on is keeping the democracy, and yet here's Erdogan usurping it. This is a recipe for a bigger blow up, guys. That's what's whether it comes out with a secularist leading it. I don't know, but
the tipping point will be if Erdogan tries to basically eliminate democracy.
Yeah,
he can get away with that. He's the Sultan. But a lot of Turks, that they still respect. They don't mean I agree with Ataturk, but they respect him. See, again, the other thing that's important thing to remember is these are not Arabs. That's something the Turks will remind you of very pointedly. And then, of course, there's also the Kurds, but let's not get into that right now. The Turks have a saying for a long time that don't involve yourself with the affairs of the Arabs. I had a Turk tell me this back in the 60s, I think. And I said, I asked him, they're terrible to manage. And basically, you appoint the nastiest, the most powerful local, Arabs and say, you can run things down here. If you can't handle it, we'll send an army and everybody will die. And that basically worked, but it was expensive. It was troublesome. You couldn't depend on them. They had the Iranians always, threatening. The Turks were the only ones who basically could push the Iranians around, and that was sometimes a near-run thing. And a lot of Turks opposed Erdogan's, attempts to make Turkey a relevant Islamic state again, state in the Islamic, Ummah, the family of Islamic states, because it meant getting involved with the Arabs. And the average Turk will tell you, well, all right, it's not Islam, it's just the way the Arabs do it. If you try and eliminate the democracy and basically depend upon Islam, I think a lot of Turks are going to say, the majority at least, are going to say, I don't think so. You know, now you have a hard time selling that in your average Arab country, because they consider themselves, you know, Muhammad was an Arab, and they take great pride in that. But for the Turks, yeah, they adopted Islam because it was convenient. The Turks are, you know, they're shrewd, and they're practical. That's why their empire lasted so long. When push comes to shove, they tend to make the right decision more often than the Arabs do. But time will tell.
All right. Real quick, I'll add one thing to that. After my Ataturk biography came out, I wrote some things for major newspapers around the U.S. In addition to my column, and that some of them ran in European papers in translation and the like. And then, of course, I gave some speeches, including one in Washington and one in New York. I had encountered some Turkish, lower-level Turkish diplomats over the years, but I ran into over 20 easily, you know, or you contact with them. And one of the things that was a common theme out of it was to say, they would say, Mr. Bey, Dr. Bey, whatever the thing is that your comment that our greatest foreign policy lever or tool is the fact that we're a democracy that happens to be Muslim, or a culturally Muslim society that happens to be a democracy. That is just true. That he says that's been, you know, I get this. That's been my experience. That's it. They were telling me in their relationships, not with just Europe, but with other Muslim nations. They would say it is a real diplomatic card. I'm directly quoting what one man said, and that's all right. That's their diplomatic core and their elites. But and of course they're talking. You know, who knows? Maybe they're, you know, there are a lot of reasons they might tell me that. But these were over, Dan. These were conversations or emails I received over about a 2-year period after the book came out, and I know it to be true. I know that to be true. That's just a reflection of what Jim says. Turks mm-hmm. know they've succeeded in a way nobody else has. Why throw it away? And that's
right.
All right.
Well, we will watch this as it continues to develop, and hopefully it will develop in a way that will be beneficial to the Turkish people. We will talk to you all next time.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.